Hello there, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. The OMI in Bookomi stands for the original memorable insights that we find in books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. This week we're sharing OMI with a leading Silicon Valley executive and tech entrepreneur whose journey to the billion-dollar boardroom has traversed the shoulders of internet giants such as Google, Amazon, and most recently the live entertainment ticketing marketplace StubHub, where she was president until its sale to Viagogo for $4 billion last year.
Hello, Bookomi. I'm Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, author of Choose Possibility, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
Currently chairman of the Board List, a premium talent marketplace, Sukhinder is also a board director at Urban Outfitters, among others. In Choose Possibility, How to Master Risk and Thrive, she invites you to reassess your relationship with risk, to replace the fear of failure with the fear of missing out, and put the all-or-nothing myth of the single choice behind you for good. If you're currently feeling like you're out of your comfort zone, but you want to progress in whatever you're doing, listen up. This one's for you. Sukhinder, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you for having me.
What is the myth of the single choice and how does it manifest itself in the way we approach our careers?
Well, I think the myth of the single choice is something we see all around us when we ascribe to successful people we see kind of our perception of what their journey must have been. And if you were to think about the movies or books you read or, in fact, risk-taking, you know, feats you might imagine from everyone from Jeff Bezos to Sir Richard Branson, you might say that these people have made single and mighty daring choices, often like one big one, that we are all celebrating. The risk to go to space, the risk to start, you know, Virgin Atlantic, whatever you might call it. But when we, or even in Star Wars, as I said, look back to popular media myths, right? The single epic choice that Han Solo made. But the problem is, when we celebrate those mighty risks, we imagine a single choice is what led people to success or failure. And thus, when we think ourselves about what it must take to be successful, we try to make this big and perfect choice. Now, that sounds great in theory, but the reality is if I said to you, make one big and perfect choice, you might well just make no choice at all because you put so much pressure on yourself. You research, and then you don't move. You know, you look at the world as rather binary and say it's either this way or this other way. And so I may need to take a big leap. And yes, I might be successful, but I also might fail mightily. So, you know, compared to that choice, I'd just rather stay where I am. So we have this perception that I call the myth of the single choice, which is this idea that success comes from one mighty risk, as opposed to the reality, which is the practice of risk-taking and making many choices sequentially to unlock a reward, which I call choosing possibility.
What I really like about the model and about the way you break down our decision-making and our choices is that it applies to other areas of life as well. I mean, leaving things, putting things off, hoping that things will be perfect. You know, that, oh, well, mm-hmm. I won't do any exercise or relax. I'll just wait until I go on holiday when I'm basically carried there. Putting things off and hoping that, thinking that you're just going to do this big reveal on anything. When actually,
yes.
Life day to day is about incremental progress, isn't it? And that's how everybody
Absolutely.
Gets to where they get to.
I think you hit it. Like, often it's about many little choices and some big choices in between, right? Only in hindsight are we able to look back and sometimes and say, that was the choice. But, you know, it's many choices, as I said, many moves to unlock a reward. So to your point, it's about the practice of choosing, even through choices that fail.
Like everyone, our brain, whatever the scale of the risk, is wired to fear failure more than we desire success. It's uh-huh. also tied up with the need to belong, to avoid shame, mm-hmm. our status mm-hmm. in society. In that moment, because there is a moment, and we mm-hmm. face crossroads every day, whether they're small or large, mm-hmm. emotional or real, that in that moment where both success and failure are on the cards, is mm-hmm. there anything we can do that you have done and that you've mm-hmm. learnt rather than, mm-hmm. you know, that you've just been born with physically to counteract the natural human instinct to run away from potential pain?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. There are many things we can do. And I think the more we practice, the good news is the little choices become a lot easier and more instinctive. But let's say that no choices come easily to you today. The practice I use, and I think you hit it a little earlier, is when we think about our fear of missing out on something, that's called the opportunity for success, and then our fear of failure, you hit the key nail on the head. In most small choices, the fear of failure is often ego risk, right? Like, what will others think of us? What will we think of ourselves? Do we look foolish if we say something? What if we're wrong, right? Just all of these things. So on little choices, even if you sort of, if you're not comfortable even with little choices, what I say to people is, okay, you can think about the success, but what I want you to do is just imagine the failure case. Imagine the failure case and really think through, you fail, what happens next? I want you to pre-mortem and kind of walk through, what are your choices after the choice? So you make the choice to speak up and nobody responds positively. Okay, what's the choice after the choice? Is it you leave the room and, you know, okay, what's the repercussion? And if it doesn't change your job, if it doesn't change your likelihood of success the next day, if you're not going to get fired, you know, when I say to people, if you have many options after a failed choice, it's a very small risk. So size it, you know, and then, you know, use it as a feedback loop. And the next time, you know, you try something, you know, you don't know if you try once, try five times. You know, and figure out what, learn what's happening each time. But often for people to reduce their fear of failure, even of small things, you have to be able to sort of live, to stop in the moment, think through the choices after the choice and be like, you know, what's the worst scenario and how many choices do I have available? And if you have many, many choices available, it's really not a big risk. Now, I know it's easy for me to say that, right? But on small choices, it turns out that the biggest thing we can do on small choices is just get into action, because the practice of doing that, just making the most incremental choice and seeing what happens, starts to indoctrinate us to small, you know, against small failures. Like, sort of, they learn to roll off your back, right? Mm-hmm. And then on truly bigger choices, obviously, we want to do a more calculated version of the same thing, right? We want to both plan for success, but really plan for all the outcomes in a failure state, so we can create contingency plans. And often, contingency plans are what get us to act actually on bigger choices. People often think it's but only dreaming of success, you know, for me, it's having contingency plans and knowing I know all the failure states on a bigger choice and how I would deal with them that actually gets me into action.
It's like knowing where all the exits are if you're in, if you're in a military situation. I really love the phrasing of your book is excellent, because you use everyday language that we use to communicate with people we care about or around the ego, you know, when you're trying to explain to your children that other people feel the same way as you. You know, it's not all about you, because... You know, we grow up, well, I don't know how you are with your kids, but we've grown up in my generation in particular, of trying to protect our children, or as most people do, but sort of trying to make everything perfect or make everything right.
Yeah.
When actually life's not like that.
Right. I mean, in some ways, we want to show people our imperfections because it makes them more comfortable taking risks. But I agree, that's very hard. It's hard for people at home, very hard for people at work. Yeah. And with our children, of course, our first instinct is to, you know, maybe his parents look perfect and to protect them, but I'm not sure that really helps them.
Yeah, they find you out eventually, as you probably know, anyway, whatever you do.
Oh, they do. They see all our imperfections, whether we want them to or not. They see them pretty clearly.
You identify leaving Google in 2009 to be the CEO of social commerce site Polyvore, and then co-founder of video retailer Joyous 1 year later, as the most risky period of your career. Now, both offerings of those, which were at the time really of the moment, are no longer with us. Would you have done anything differently? Could you have done anything differently, knowing what you know now?
Well, it's interesting. I think they're very different failures, and I think this is really important because it's one of the lessons of the book. First of all, both failures were on the way to becoming an e-commerce expert, which was what ultimately led to the ability to lead StubHub. So ironically, I went on a journey leaving Google to become an e-commerce executive, and I started at Polyvore, which is a startup, and then I ran my own, and then I ran StubHub. And one would argue that I met my ultimate ambition, which was to run a large multi-billion-dollar e-commerce company. It just wasn't the one I thought it was. So there's a lesson in the book that, you know, when you keep choosing through failures and get the learnings and can create impact, and I'll come to that in a moment, you can still have compounding benefit, right? But it's about creating impact. So you point to those two things and would I have done anything differently. In the case of Polyvore, which was a job I went to straight after being an executive at Google, I took over a 10-person e-commerce company, where the founder, you know, had pursued me for many years to come run it. And I finally said yes. And within 6 months, I was out because he wanted to be CEO again. And yeah. he sort of told the board, like, it's Sukhinder or me. And they chose him. Like, when you think about that risk, mighty risk to leave a multi-billion dollar job and, you know, running a multi-billion dollar business and to, you know, go to a startup and fail. Like, not fail well, fail poorly in the sense that we have this battle. So in that case, I felt very unsatisfied because I had no impact. I was there 6 months. Like, I mean, you know, like not only did it fail, I can't even point to it and say, you know, any of its success, it later sold to Yahoo for $300 million, had to do with me. So in that case, what I say to people is ultimately our failing, his and mine, was a very painful lesson. And when we go places where our values don't overlap with the people on whom with whom we're working or even dependent on our success, or even who might have power over us. And I know many people don't enter jobs as a CEO. So even when you are the CEO, you're still in scenarios where people may have, you know, power over you if they're the founder or the board or what have you. When you fail to have values overlap, it's not a very safe place to take a risk. It's not a very, and it's not a place where long term, I think we do our best work. So what's my hindsighting of that? I always say to people, he and I were very intellectually well matched. Like, you know, we had met many times. We had lots of good ideas. I had done due diligence. You know, sometimes I think, was there any other way for me to know what it would really be like to work with him before I took a risk? Well, maybe one. Maybe I could have become a consultant. You know, it's true. I was, you know, I was unemployed at the time. I could have said, hey, let's work together for 3 months. Yeah. You know, instead I, you know, now I had done, you know, I had known him for 3 years and I had, and I knew the investors and so on. So like, I can minorly critique it. That's also just a case of like, risk is risk, you know, but my learning out of that, it's only the second time in my career where I went to a place where almost from day one, I felt like my values didn't, like something was off in terms of the worldview of the person I was working with or for and my own worldview. And that ultimately, in both those things, cracked open. I was out of both jobs in 6 months. And every other place I've ever been, including Joyce, which we'll come to, my own startup, I've been between 5 and 7 years and had like, and run like multiple, you know, cycles of success and failure and ultimately achieve my ambitions or not. But I know I have a body of work that I'm proud of. And so to your point on Joyce, Joyce was a video commerce startup, which is very hot now. Video shopping is very hot. But when I started it, it was, you know, 2011. And there was no video shopping to speak of. And by the way, people would laugh at us when we said we're going to sell, you know, fashion beauty items by showcasing them on online video. I mean, I couldn't find anybody who wanted to carry our videos. YouTube was the only place that really was a large video channel. Facebook and Instagram hadn't even launched video when we started. And so we found it very hard to make the economics of that business work. What I really mean by that is find customers who wanted to watch and shop on videos at a profitable cost. By the way, you know, we built that company for 7 years. We had patents. We were the first mover. We got it to $20 million in annual revenue. I built a team I'm extraordinarily proud of. They went on to do other things. So it was in 2017, what you're referring to is, you know, we had taken a lot of funding in. We were large, but we weren't profitable. And the path to profitability was quite challenging. We still, like the math was good, but we still had to use too much money to grow. And venture capitalists saw that too and didn't want to continue to fund the company. And so I sold it for a small sum. And lo and behold, 2 to 3 years later, Pinduoduo launches in China, showing, proving that video commerce can be profitable. TikTok, Instagram video, Facebook video all now offer shoppable video options. And people are willing now, 11 years later, to watch Apple video. So I call that the risk of being an innovator. And I don't mean that to flatter myself. I'm just saying when you go first, particularly in tech, there's no guarantee you'll be the last man standing. Because you're waiting for sort of the customer and the macro environment in some ways. You're waiting for a trend to emerge, right? And you're sort of betting that you can hasten that trend. It's different to ride a trend. That's a really smart risk. You know, when you take the risk to go first, it's a really fun and impactful journey. It, the world may or may not move at the speed you're moving. Does that make sense? And may welcome your innovation or not. It may be too early. And the world is full of examples of innovation that was too early, where the customer wasn't ready to adopt. So Joyce, I ran for 6.5 years before we sold it. It was personally very disappointing. But also, I look back and I can point to the impact we had and the culture we created and the company we created. And I still can feel proud of it because I feel like we had impact. And that's the difference between failures you can live with and failures that are really hard to live with. So in that case, would I have done anything differently? You know, interestingly, people ask me that now. My only regret is maybe I should have tried to find an alternative source of funding and hung in 2 years longer, because that same company today, honestly would arguably be worth hundreds of millions of dollars if you just look at the comps in technology today. So what looks stupid, you know, when I was finishing, now looks like incredibly smart, and there are video commerce companies starting every day. So my only regret actually in that case is maybe I should have found one more way to take a risk.
I was involved in an early cable TV channel, a youth channel called Rapture TV, which ultimately failed after 3 or 4 years. But during that 3 or 4 years, because we hired all new staff, the careers that were launched out of that are amazing. Mm-hmm. And the relationships. So there is always a positive you can take out of it without trying to change the narrative of the past.
Never want to change the narrative. But to your point, you're building career capital. You're building relationships. Yeah. You're building impact. But I think you and I both agree, like you can probably look back on that period and say, what were the skills that accelerated for me? What were the people I met? By the way, what did taking that risk lead to ultimately? Somewhere in your career, you've become an entrepreneur again. You know, people value that experience, I'm sure, because you've shown an agility that, quite frankly, the average person doesn't show.
Reading your book and talking to you has actually given me some insight on the past, because where values are wrong, because you can control anything. You can, you can control what you do. You can control where you work, but what you can't control are the values of other individuals. And I've taken a promotion in the past, which on paper looked amazing, but was the worst thing to do because I didn't share the values of the people around me or my peers. And very quickly moved from success to failure. I'm not talking about people who commit crimes, as I'm sure you're not talking about when your values clash, but some people just, there's just a core difference, whether it be experience or anything else.
Yeah, well, you're hitting, I think, a bunch of things that are really fun and important to your point. Like, when do you sort of have confidence in yourself and your ability without overreaching and believe that you control everything, right? Like you said, unless you happen to be the sole founder with all the power, who basically, you know, is like, take it or leave it. And even then, by the way, it's not a very scalable way to build a company if nobody can absolutely, you know, nobody sticks around long enough to actually help you build what you want to build. But like, so let's put aside the, you know, the dictatorship type companies, which do exist. But what I would say is what you point to. I often feel that this question of what we don't control is as important in risk-taking as what we do control. And what can you assess about who else is on that journey and any career risk you take, you know, in making it successful? And really, it's the people we're working with. And so, you know, one of the things I really have taken away from my own career is putting more thought into the who of our choices is really clear, because we think it's all about us. But to your point, it's us in concert with a group of other people trying to find success together. And if they complement our strengths and they kind of value our strengths, but they complement what we are and have bring diversity to the table, but share our values, we kind of do some of our best work. And people are like, to your point, they're like, what do you mean values? Like, because you're right, I haven't worked with anybody who's criminal, but you know, just the way we move through an organization and what we think is like fair and right and just, you know what I mean? Our sense of like how we want to show up and how other people want to show up when that's not the same thing, then it is hard to find our best work.
It can be micro things as well, because I think when you grow up in your 20s, say, and you're rising up with people, you're sharing success and failure, even if they're very different to you, you rub along and you find a way to share values. Mm-hmm. When you get to the executive level, where suddenly you've got to kind of speed date your way to values, haven't you?
Yes.
Unless you're very clear from the beginning what they are, that's when the clashes happen, because you know, people have become set in their value systems and what they think. This can be as micro as how the staff use the canteen, or your attitude to smoking or drinking or anything, anything, your attitude, anything which, if you've grown up with people or you've been through stuff, you don't really mind because you know they're right. And most people are basically good. They want to be good.
Yes. Yeah, most people are good. Most people are good.
But it becomes a competition very quickly as the higher up I think you get. Anyway, that's my therapy over with for dealing with the past. You talk about putting your hands on the wheel throughout your career, driving growth through your career. Grow or go is your mantra throughout the book. Don't you ever feel, as an individual, don't you ever feel like stopping for a bit? And if not, what drives you forward? What is your locus of control? Surely you don't, you know, there must have been moments in your career where you go, you know what, I just can't be bothered with this anymore.
Oh, for sure. So first of all, I believe it or not, in between almost every chapter of my career, and I've obviously been lucky that I've saved money and made money. But even when I was younger, I lived in Britain for quite a while, as you're aware. I worked at Merrill Lynch, and then I worked at B Sky B, which you would know. My dogs are walking in here. Hold on
Are they
one sec.
trained to, are they trained to bark when you say B Sky B?
No, that they aren't, but it is pretty funny. Maybe they should, given how aggressive that culture is. Even from when I was young, and as long as I had a little bit of money saved, believe it or not, between every career chapter, I've taken a break. So right now, I mean, I left StubHub a year ago. Now, I wrote the book in that year, but it's not the same thing as being, in a day job. Like that was, I was literally, I had planned when we sell StubHub, I'm going to have this period off because I'm not going to get to be the CEO of the combined company. We were acquired by Viagogo, as you know. And so I was like, I'm going to write the book and think about what's next. So interestingly, for somebody who runs as hard as me, as people often say, I do actually. There are times I just like when a chapter is over, I don't want to commit myself to the next thing. Number two, you would be, most people chuckle like on the weekends, I don't want all my weekends planned. I used to say to people when my children were younger, we were not the family where it was like, baseball to soccer practice to piano lessons. Like on the weekend, I was like, oh, 5 days a week. Like I am so scheduled on the weekend. I don't want my kids to be scheduled. I just want to hang out with them. I want to be able to make pancakes. So like I'm quite binary. And that for me is really important, right? And now my husband would say I'm on email all the time, but let's just all agree that COVID is this weird period that bleeds into our personal lives. But historically, if I went on a vacation, I'd say to my teams, like I'd be like, literally, guys, if you want me, text me. The minute I open my email, I tell you what will happen. I will work several hours that day. I don't want to. Like if I open my email, my stress levels will go up. So I think you just have to figure out what tactics for yourself. And for me, there's like little rest periods, in a period, like I'm on any career journey, at least I say to people, it's like 5 to 7 years. For some people, it's 30. But for me, like, when I commit to something, I'm committing for at least the next 5 years. So like to sustain yourself, you need all those little breaks, right? And for different people, it's different things. I binge watch. I'm like, I want to turn off my mind shopping, just like the next person. I have my own little tactics. For my husband, it's, he has to get, multiple types of exercise every day, whatever it is. But I'd say in bigger chapters, I always want to take a pause and a breather. So that's true. So my life does go in cycles. So don't presume for a moment I don't need a rest. And on this question of locus of control, I think that, I think for me, my feeling about myself is I always have the ability to respond and I always have the ability to anticipate. I don't believe any longer I have the ability to get it all right, but I believe that I can be in this continuous process. And to be honest, that's where all my sense of control comes from. I'm like, and this is the sad but true. I always say the sad but important truth. The older you are and the more experience you have, the more confidence I have in my own agility. Like, not my own perfection, my own agility. I'm like, look, if I have survived this many things, there will be a way. I can't guarantee that every way will be successful, but there's always a way out of something if you just weirdly stay in. Like, the way out is not to quit. The way out is just to stay in and find little ways to sustain yourself and just keep choosing. So for me, if there's a moment where I'm like, I'm in a very difficult situation, for me, the most important thing is to do whatever I need in that situation to not quit. Does that make sense? Because
It
for me,
does, yeah.
quitting is when I feel failure. And like I said, I already feel failure that, maybe I gave up on Joyous too early at 7 years. But I always know that if I can just sustain, whatever that means, if I've had a bad week, it means like not sending an email till Monday. If there's some crisis going on with the company or the board, it literally is like, talk to my coach. What do I need to do, like, in order, like maybe I need to get a good night's sleep. Just what are the tactics to stay in?
Often staying on the pitch and staying in isn't about continuing to do the same thing harder,
Yes,
tightening up.
that's right.
It's about stepping back slightly. Only regrets I have professionally are where I've sort of given up, where I've gone, but it was because I was just trying too hard to do the same thing and it wasn't getting anywhere. What I should have done, you need to step aside or step back. But these are the benefits of wisdom through age, aren't they?
Well, you said one thing I think that I really like, right? I think this is maybe the key phrase: step back, don't step off. I like that phrase. Like, often we think we have to step off. It's this binary choice. I'm like, what if it isn't binary? What if you just step back and you kind of, to your point, you retrench so that you can make the next choice? Do you know what I mean? If you step off, sometimes there is no next choice. But staying on the pitch, as you would say, but stepping back maybe to the sidelines, it's okay. Yeah. I do it all the time.
To my next question, about experience. Do you think our attitude to risk changes as we get older and the avenue of possibilities narrow? I'm thinking of it more in a negative way. Mm-hmm. Like, do we start thinking, oh, we've got, you know, more mouths to feed, mortgages to pay, that we shouldn't be taking risks and seeking out possibility as we get older in our career?
Yes, I think this is a critical question. So I have some data on this, and then I have, you know, obviously my own personal opinion. So first of all, I do think that as we get older, ironically, it's not that risk goes away, they just change. And, you know, many people think the biggest risk is financial risk, but you and I just talked about the biggest one. It's called ego risk. It's literally this risk of like, what will others think of us and what will we think of ourselves? It's amazing to me how powerful this risk is for all of us, because I think it comes to our sense of self-identity, you know what I mean? And if we see ourselves as imperfect, for some people, that's just very scary. And then if other people tell us we're imperfect, that sort of then reinforces that scariness. I think that our ego risk grows when we have more to lose. In some ways, I remember like that point at which I was going to leave Google, I ultimately took the risk, but I was at my most insecure when I had the most success, when my track record looked closer to perfect. You know what I mean? Because then the risk of like what happens. And I really thought that if I failed at Polyvore, I was done. If you ask me the immediate moments after, I'm like, what will people think of me? I'm so ashamed, all of those things. So I do think that the risks change. And then I think, to be fair, let's not count out the personal risk. We have families to consider. We have another spouse. We have those risks are real. The risk of what makes us happy, the risk of our families being happy. Like, so there, it just gets more complicated. But it doesn't, risk doesn't go away. In some ways, it grows. So the data on this is, I don't know if you went, you obviously read the book, which I'm so flattered that you would read the whole thing.
I would say to people,
you can't presume people read the whole book. Some people do, some people browse the chapters, whatever. But you clearly read it end to end. But there's a quiz that's not in the book, but that's on my website. You can take, it's called a risk quiz. And before we put it out, we tested with a sample of the U.S. population. And what we found is that demographically, people who are wealthier are two extreme cases on our risk profile. Number one, they're more likely to be what's called change seekers, which is more comfortable taking risk. In fact, comfortable like seeking and dealing with a lot of change. And also more likely to be on the other extreme of archetypes, which is called the critic. Most likely to see the negative in any situation, although they have the most financial freedom to take risk. People who are in the higher income demographics can pivot on either side. And that to me seems very right. I see people who are, in my sphere and friends and colleagues who literally struggle with even the smallest decision because they get caught up in these complicated set of risks. And I see, and they're easy to see the negatives, right? That also comes with experience. And others who are like very agile. So it's ironic that freedom financially doesn't give people, you know, more appetite to take risk only. It gives them both more fear and more appetite.
What's the one piece of advice you would give to someone who might be worried about going back into the physical network post-lockdown? Mm-hmm. How should they get themselves out there when their body is screaming at them to stay in there?
Yeah, it's a good question. Showing up for me in this moment, and maybe for you, is I now crave more physical interaction, but I also want it to be like valuable and give me energy. And I, you know, it's weird, right? Zoom drains our energy. But now we're also at risk when we go out, like, you know, maybe going to work every day drains our energy because you're dealing with politics again. By the way, the nice thing about Zoom is like to like politic at work is like literally to have to go set up another Zoom call or phone call. To have what used to be a water cooler conversation where you could, you know, quite frankly, bitch all you want about some bad situation at work. So politics have kind of disappeared. And like, so what's left is sort of like work. But to your point, it's also the absence of connection. So what do I think? I think that people should find a speed in which, you know, they seek the interactions that give them energy. For me, I'm really craving brainstorming as a physical interaction. Like, you know what? Doing it on Zoom, not only is it not the same, it's not fun. Like brainstorming is meant to be fun. I mean, I don't want to do it on a virtual whiteboard. I want to be in a room and feel the energy of others and somebody says something and somebody responds, right? So I think it's about finding, like, you know, examining for yourself what physical interactions give you energy and moving towards those. And maybe for the first time, a hybrid environment gives you that possibility. So I know what it is for myself. I'm discerning it. I know that there's some interactions that totally drain me and I'm happy to be done with them. Like the idea of going to work and like literally just having a stream of people set up one-on-ones with me where they just want to bitch about like what the food is in the cafeteria or whatever, the CEO gets those too. I'm like, really? This is what you want to talk to me about? I honestly don't have a lot of time for this. So you go talk to somebody else about this. But I don't get a lot of them. But you get the point. I want to have really positive interactions and energy-filled interactions in the time I'm now going to use for physical interaction. But the bar's gone up.
Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, thank you for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Thank you so much.
Sukhinder's book, Choose Possibility, How to Master Risk and Thrive, can be purchased from our independent bookselling partner, Primrose Hill Books. Just follow the link in the episode description. And if you'd like to maximize the potential OMI in your life, please like and subscribe to the Bokomi Cast on your Apple, Spotify or audio platform, and follow us at Bokomi on Twitter or Instagram. There's even a Facebook page if you're that way inclined. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe, but not too safe. Bye for now.